Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Lance Thurner. This week I'll be speaking with Professor Robert Foulkes about his new book, The Ethnobotany of Eden, Rethinking the Jungle Medicine Narrative, out by University of Chicago Press in 2018. This is an excellent and compelling assessment of the origins of our contemporary fascination with tropical cures and the occult medical wisdom of indigenous cultures. Wielding his considerable experience in the field of ethnobotany, Foulkes traces the long history of biopiracy through European colonialism and calls into question our ingrained assumptions about virgin nature, native knowledge, and miracle medicines. More than that, Foulkes argues that appropriative bioprospecting has been largely a fail, and that radical critiques of biopiracy have often partaken in the same stereotypes and assumptions about indigeneity. In this timely volume, Foulkes brings together a wealth of current scholarship to suggest a different grounding for responsible ethnobotanical research and intervention. I'm very pleased to be sharing with you today my interview with Robert Foulkes, and I hope you enjoy it. Well, okay, Professor Robert Foulkes, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society and our show.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, so I'm so pleased to be talking about this book, which I've enjoyed immensely, and I really value a lot on a lot of levels. I mean, one, because it makes a very timely intervention. Another level, because it brings so much wisdom in the field to this, to analyzing, kind of looking over the field of ethnobotany and where it's gone and where it needs to go. And because it brings together so much material that it exists in various specialist literatures, but I've never seen it quite brought together so well. Can you tell a little bit about the origin of this project, this book project, and how you came to decide it needed to be written?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I had been working in the Atlantic forests of eastern Brazil on and off for some years. And I had been working on a project exploring the arrival of enslaved people during the slave trade, and in particular, how it was that they managed to maintain many of their healing traditions. And I started going to different ceremonies. It's a group called the Candomblé, which is has analogs up and down from the Caribbean down through South America. At any rate, so I was out collecting a lot of medicinal plants, and I was spending a lot of time with healers of African descent, and my pharmacopoeia that I'd collected was almost exclusively weedy plants and garden cultivars or really, really common second growth species. And I began to wonder whether or not the medicinal and healing plants that I was working with, whether this was really a result of sort of the status of Africans as immigrants in South America. And so I contacted a person in the region that was known to be particularly knowledgeable about the healing flora. His name was Indio, which just means Indian, of course. And so we got together on a Saturday morning, and I just wanted to go out with somebody who was really knowledgeable and start looking at the question. So we went walking through these neighborhoods. We started in a favela, and you know, he'd point out this herb and this plant over here, and he went over the garden wall and said, these plants over here are used for this and this and this. And we kept walking along, and the trails, you know, were, you know, sprinkled with plants that he said were part of the healing flora. We got to a second growth area. This was in the old cocoa zone. And we got to a second growth area that had been cut and burned, and he's identified a lot of medicinal species there. And, you know, finally, we got to some old growth forest, and he explained what he'd said all along. He said, you know, there really aren't very many healing plants in old growth forests. It's mostly in disturbed areas and weedy areas and trails. And so I wondered whether I really had a very good informant at that point or not. But this was kind of contrary to what at least I thought about the location of medicinal plants in the tropics. And so I went back to California and I got a small grant to go back and investigate it. And so I set up a couple of 1 hectare, 100 meter by 100 meter plots in a severely disturbed area, basically a messy jungle, and a couple of 1 hectare plots in old growth forest in this Atlantic coastal forest of Brazil. And then I contacted three people who were known to be reputable healers in the region. And we went out and investigated and looked basically at all the useful plants in all four of these different areas, identifying foods and fibers, plants used in crafts, but especially the medicinal species. And what we came back with and what I ultimately published was the idea that, at least in this particular region, old growth forests were simply not that important in terms of people's daily medicinal needs. That in fact, they usually just went back in the garden, they had some cultivars, they went out to the fields, they had some weeds. And so it kind of at that point that it made me begin to question this whole idea, this narrative that had been sort of organically evolving in the West. The tropical forests were this super important source of potential pharmaceutical drug plants. And that, of course, as a result of deforestation, at that time, sort of connected to what we call the hamburger connection, that these forests and also the people who were knowledgeable about these plants was being lost. And I began to question it, and that's where it started. And so I kind of ruminated on this. This was many years ago, and I kind of ruminated on this over the years. And I went out and did a couple of other studies looking at other dimensions of it. But anyway, that's how it started.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this book, and at least how it begins, is although much of the book is a critique of this idea of the jungle medicine narrative, you begin with some basic science that kind of supports why it is people at first look to the rainforest as being a site to find pharmaceuticals.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at all of the reasons, you know, what kind of a habitat would you expect to find a large proportion of these, what we call secondary compounds, that are oftentimes bioactive in plants? And These are the compounds that in several instances have transitioned into pharmaceutical drug plants. And so if that's your objective, obviously the tropics have myriad more species of plants than any other biome on the planet. It literally goes up orders of magnitude. For example, I have some property up in northern Oregon, 12 acres, and we have a total of 7 species of trees on my 12 acres. Not exactly biodiverse. And we have a 1 hectare plot near where I had been studying in eastern Brazil. Again, 100 meters by 100 meters that had over 400 species of trees. So if just biodiversity is what you're looking for, you're going to get your most bang for your buck from the tropics. But then even beyond that, there's all these other reasons why tropical plants just tend to have or be richer in these secondary compounds. This has to do with the ecology of the tropics. So there's all kinds of reasons why tropical forests are the right place to look.
And so, but when does this emerge in scientific literature, but also more in popular culture in the United States and elsewhere, that that these are the pharmacopoeia of the world, and that humanity needs to plumb them for our greatest medicines?
Well, I think that, I mean, personally, from my perspective, and I was reading the literature, I think Dr. Norman Myers in the UK, who's an ecologist and environmental scientist, He published some really influential essays that really got me interested in the topic. And I think he was kind of the first person to start putting some of the different elements of the narrative together. He talked first about the development of vincristine and vinblastine, these two alkaloids found in the Madagascar periwinkle, a plant that at the time they didn't talk about what its habitat was, which of course becomes an issue later on, but it's a plant that during the 1960s, there was experimentation done on it to identify if it could be used as an oral treatment for diabetes, which did not pan out. But they ultimately discovered that it had a really, really strong effect on various cancers and childhood leukemia. And so, in fact, you know, the percentage of children that survived in the 1960s were like 5%. And with the introduction of this bioactive compound from the tropics, the survival rate is something like 95% now, and oncologists say it's basically a manageable disease. I think most of the beginning of the narrative started with that, and he also talked, you know, Eli Lilly Corporation had the patent, and so there was lots of money to be made. There was another dimension to it, which ultimately did get pharmaceutical companies interested for a spell. And then, of course, that sort of naturally moved into the area of the crisis in the tropics. And this is just about the time in the early 1980s when we were getting word about, especially in Central America to begin with, that Central America's rainforests were being chopped down ignominiously in order to produce more cattle to send up to the United States for the burgeoning fast food industry. So we had the real beginning of it, I think, with Norman Meyer's work. And then I just think from there it caught on. It caught on, I think, as I point out in the book in various places, because I feel like we've, you know, humanity, at least the West, has always had this kind of love affair with the mystery of the tropics. And so someone coming forth and saying we have these mysterious drug plants, you know, that could treat some of our most horrific diseases, I think it resonated with us.
Yeah. So, you know, this book is, most of it is a deconstruction of this idea of the jungle medicine narrative and a genealogy of where this idea comes from and how it dovetails with much of Western intellectual tradition and why it isn't quite correct and isn't quite useful in as we go forward. And I'm wondering why it is that, you know, and to begin with, that you think that this idea requires a critique.
Good question. Well, I think, you know, in many respects, the jungle medicine narrative is kind of an autobiography of my changing understanding of the Western view of tropical forests. And because I've been working there since the 1980s, when I first went, I had a very, very romanticized notion of what the tropics were all about. I had the notion in my mind of a virgin landscape that was very much in need of outsiders coming in to help local people understand how to take care of their nature. I had a very romanticized notion about indigenous relations with tropical nature. I knew nothing about the sort of history of exploitation of tropical forests. I knew nothing about the questions of biopiracy. And so the whole evolution of the narrative, it went forth, you know, very organically. It wasn't, you know, it was a strategy ultimately employed by the environmental community. But I also worry about the idea of using environmental narratives to convey sometimes complex issues to the general public. And I think that particularly in the area of environmental science, where these problems tend not to be very easy to identify cause and effect, they're very slowly evolving. I think that we have to be very, very careful about how we construct them. And in this particular instance, and certainly other instances, you know, narratives become calcified in society. They resonate, and then it's very, very hard to change them. And so then, you know, we start looking for the tropics, and we expect to find a certain thing all the time. We expect the shamans to all be men. we expect we need to save old growth forests because, of course, that's where all the medicinal plants are, et cetera, et cetera. And so I simply tried to tease out what I considered to be all of the salient elements in this narrative and to see which ones were spot on and which ones were kind of gray and fuzzy and which ones just were not correct at all.
Yeah. And can you give us a little overview of what you think, what are the key elements of the jungle medicine narrative?
Absolutely. Well, I think I started off on the more metaphoric view of the tropics, because to begin with, most of us don't, you know, most Westerners don't ever get into the tropics, and they do, it's, you know, a brief eco tour, and where a lot of times they end up, you know, passing along the same kinds of misinformation as we already have. But at any rate, we start off by looking at the, you know, the virgin nature of tropical forests and what are tropical forests and to what degree are they a product of you know, natural processes, climate and soils and, you know, those kinds of speciation events. And to what degree are they, in fact, humanized landscapes? And one of the things that geographers and anthropologists and biologists have discovered over the last 40 years or so is that tropical forests are very much a reflection of human actions. You know, the composition of forests, especially, for example, if you go into the Mayan country of the Yucatan, you know, as you get closer and closer to ancient villages, you identify that more and more of the tree species are useful. And useful meaning that the composition of these forests was changed 1,000 years ago, and that even though as a Westerner you walk through and it still looks like absolute pristine virgin nature, in fact, a lot of what you're seeing is a result of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of manipulation by human beings. And so I move from there into the idea of noble forest dwellers, the way that we have kind of culturally constructed who lives in the forest and how their knowledge of the forest is useful to us. I try to go back and look at the earliest thoughts about people in the equatorial realm, what the ancients thought, and then when the colonial people arrived in Africa and Latin America, how they kind of redefined them, you know, lazy, shiftless, sexual people that could be exploited. And then, you know, the arrival of the Romantics, especially Alexander von Humboldt, and how he helped redefine our relationship and our views of indigenous people. All of these kind of go through, you know, evolution of ideas, and sometimes they come back again and sometimes they revert. I looked at the early bioprospecting during the colonial era, looking for kind of antecedents to the kinds of things that have been taking place beginning in the 1980s, and found lots and lots of parallels. Kind of the one thing that is a recurring theme is the idea that indigenous folk are not sufficiently intelligent to manage their own resources and to appreciate how important they are. And so they are deserving of outside intervention in order to protect these resources. And that's a theme that has come up again and again. I then slipped into the idea of whether or not, you know, the origin of the idea of medicinal plants coming out of the forest and their transition to pharmaceuticals, it was connected to old growth forests. And the idea that these precious, barely touched forested landscapes were where all of these potential pharmaceutical drugs were located. And that's, of course, why we needed to protect them. And given that little research project I'd done years before, I started exploring it more thoroughly and discovered, along with many, many other people, because there's been a lot of other research on, in terms of the habitats that are associated with healing floras, and discovered there's all kinds of reasons why old growth forests are really incredibly important in terms of all kinds of ethnobotanical uses. But for the most part, medicinal plants are not part of it. Medicinal plants actually do much, much better in sort of open space areas, less biodiverse areas, along trails and in burned over areas, et cetera, et cetera. So that was kind of a challenge to the idea that we needed to save the world's rainforests in order to save the medicinal plants. I think I stated at one point in the book, you know, one could say that, in fact, cutting down the forest and burning it would you know, dramatically enhance the number of medicinal plants. And I'm saying that, of course, tongue in cheek. But at any rate, the last couple of major elements, one that I think probably I would connect to the Sean Connery movie, The Medicine Man, that came out in 1992, but was also carried on by ethnobotanists. And that is that that these healing traditions are not only in the rainforest, but they are maintained by mostly male shamans. And this connection between male shamans and the mysteries of the healing properties of the forest certainly was perpetuated by, you know, the doyen of ethnobotany, Richard Evans Schultes, from Harvard. And it was carried on for many, a generation, basically, because in the early days, almost all ethnobotanists were male. And for all kinds of reasons, and this certainly includes me in the field, I was as guilty as anyone else. I was not allowed to work with women, certainly in the field. And so everything I learned was from men. And so you come up with this association of, you know, indigenous male folk being sort of these reservoirs of medicinal knowledge. And in fact, it turns out that there are all kinds of reasons, including ecological, but socio-cultural as well, is why it is that women tend to actually be more imbued with the knowledge of the healing properties of tropical nature. My last couple of the elements, one that I found particularly important from my own perspective, because my own research over the years, for the most part, was looking at diaspora people, people that had been forcefully brought to the Americas during the slave trade. And one of the kind of axioms of bioprospecting is that you work with indigenous people. You don't work with people that at one time or another were immigrants. And in fact, one of the very, very first articles I submitted for publication, it was accepted ultimately, but one of the reviewers really took me to task. And he said, if you want to learn about the healing flora of a region, you need to work with indigenous people, you know, not the descendants of enslaved people. And so there's been a lot of research by people in the last 25 years looking at people of African descent in the Americas and the tremendous amount of knowledge that they have in terms of the healing flora. So I used that chapter to kind of dispel the myth that we had to go off and find folks that had been in place forever. And finally, the last point was one that I actually went out and researched myself, and that is the widespread notion among ethnobotanists that we are very, very rapidly losing our cognitive association with tropical nature, that people are abandoning the knowledge of medicinal plants and other things, but also medicinal plants seem to be particularly vulnerable to erosion. And you get this from almost everybody who works in the field. And I'm the editor of a journal called Economic Botany. And I would say that probably half of the articles that I receive for publication at some point say, you know, and we lament the fact that young people are no longer interested in medicinal plants. And so this is the last generation that's going to be able to have any knowledge. And therefore, if we're interested in plumbing the indigenous knowledge about medicinal plants, we better do it quickly. And so I went out and did a study in eastern Brazil with a Brazilian colleague to look at this question. And indeed found that knowledge of nature was declining very, very rapidly in this community. The chapter in the book explores this more thoroughly because it's a challenging question. You know, we don't have longitudinal profiles going back 100 years to know what people knew in the past. And so basically we go into a community now and I identify what younger people know, what middle-aged people know, and what older people know. And of course, you know, there's the inherent bias there of we assume that older people know more than younger people. But having said that, from all the different ways that this topic has been explored, it does very much appear that our knowledge of the healing properties of tropical nature is declining pretty precipitously. Anyway, those are the major elements, and I try to tie them together in an objective way. I didn't really have an axe to grind specifically, but I thought it would be interesting to try to tease out all the different features of it and see which ones had the most veracity and which ones did not.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. You know, one of the kind of elemental features of the jungle medicine narrative, and one that is at least a few hundred years old, is the idea that indigenous knowledge of nature is a different kind of knowledge. It's more innate, it's less conscious, it's more of being with one with nature, it's more animal-esque. And this is an idea that one can trace pretty loudly with and vocally within colonial literature, but is one that continues today, in which this kind of knowledge is thought to be timeless in a sense. And I'm wondering about, as you're looking across this field and reconsidering this jungle medicine narrative in light of your own experience with weedy plants and otherwise, if this really changes our idea about what it means when people know nature, non-Western people or people, not non-scientific nature.
Well, if you're talking about the relationship between our perception of people in the tropics and how they have a more intimate knowledge of nature,
is that where but we're also going? The sense that what they know isn't a rational sort of knowledge of nature, but rather is something deeply innate and cultural.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, and you're familiar with the colonial literature also, and this is something that I explore to a limited degree in the book. As colonial authorities were out looking for these healing plants, and they used various sort of axioms to try to track them down, things like the doctrine of signatures, you know, identifying plants because heart-shaped leaves, you know, could cure the heart, and, you know, white latex coming out of a tree indicated it was good for lactation, that sort of thing. But they ultimately did hit upon the idea that indigenous folk were touchstones for this knowledge. And the literature seems to, you know, both the original literature and that's come out more recently, does sort of suggest that colonial authorities saw this as sort of bestial knowledge, that there was something in terms of that great chain of being, whereby, you know, there's more and more association with wild nature as you move from God to the angels to civilized people to uncivilized people and down to the beasts. And that because these so-called uncivilized indigenous folk live close to nature and they're surrounded by wildlife, there's the idea that their knowledge is not something that was acquired through intellectual experimentation and scientific empiricism, that it's something that they just sort of blindly inherited. And that's one of the important themes, certainly, as you're aware from the colonial literature, is the idea that because indigenous folks inherited this not by scientific method, but by association with the wildness of nature, that somehow this isn't really intellectual property, that this is sort of brute knowledge. And since it wasn't acquired by intellectual action, it meant that basically outsiders could come in and steal it. And there wasn't any notion of intellectual property.
And do you see that idea as something that persisted as this jungle medicine narrative really develops in the 1960s and 70s?
Yeah, I think that that's been around forever. And I can tell you that I went back and investigated the question of when we started in the West, certainly in the scientific community, talking about intellectual property of indigenous folks and nature. And even up and through the 1960s and 1970s, certainly field researchers have always had, you know, for a couple of generations, great, great respect for people in the field. But at the same time, I don't believe that they really considered to be intellectual endeavor, and I don't believe they considered to be intellectual property. I ran into an article in the 1970s in our journal, Economic Botany, where a woman researcher sort of seemed to laugh in it, say, you know, and it's so interesting, the local people here actually consider this to be something of intellectual property, when, of course, this is really, you know, a commons a prop resource that any of us should have access to.
And so one of the things that this jungle medicine narrative lends itself to is this controversy over bioprospecting and biopiracy in the 80s and 90s. And I'm wondering a little bit about both the ways, I guess the ways that the jungle medicine narrative serves both sides of that argument, that this is knowledge that needs to be appropriated and for the health of humankind, or that it's intellectual property belonging to a certain group of people that's being exploited by Western pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, that's a really good question and a super appropriate question. As I try to point out in the book, The Jungle Medicine Narrative, in many respects, in the last couple of decades, has been supplanted by the biopiracy narrative, suggesting that bioprospecting for the healing floor of the tropics is just one more stage of the inappropriate exploitation of, you know, indigenous folk and their knowledge. In terms of medicinal plants and looking for examples of biopiracy, there are almost no examples. And I think that when you get into the agronomic literature in terms of, you know, land races of beans and things like that, there are some good examples of people, you know, Westerners going down to Mexico, seeing some cool beans, bringing them back and trying to put a patent on them. But my own research and my own perception of the question of biopiracy in the area of medicinal plants is that it's really something that kind of ended during the colonial era. It isn't something that has gone on for at least a generation. I can't think of a single pharmaceutical drug plant that was developed in the last 70 years that was as a result of inappropriate exploitation of indigenous knowledge. I mean, part of that obviously is because it takes a long, long time to develop a drug, even though you identify that it has this use in the field. And so in some ways, and I'm not trying to completely denigrate the idea of biopiracy as a narrative, but it's one of those things that really resonated with people. I mean, big pharma is really easy to hate. For all kinds of reasons. And so suggesting that indigenous folks are having their knowledge exploited by, you know, ethnobotanical errand boys sent down by Big Pharma to, you know, make the next great pharmaceutical discovery so they can come back and make $1 billion off of it. It's just one of those things that really, really resonates well. And honestly, there just aren't any examples of it. And even when there are, you know, notions of the example, even with vincristine, for example, that came from the Madagascar periwinkle, there have been, you know, dozens, and there are so many articles written on biopiracy. And there are suggestions that, you know, the plant originally comes from Madagascar, and so that the pharmaceutical corporation that developed vincristine should somehow go back to Madagascar, you know, and somehow compensate the country or the people. But the plant is a weed. And it's been a weed that's been scattered all over the tropical and subtropical world for at least 200 years. Its identification as a possible medicinal plant was made by a man in the Caribbean. So at any rate, what I'm saying is I think that the the attitude towards indigenous people as reservoirs of this knowledge, I think that it has certainly changed over the years. And every ethnobotanist that works in the field now follows a very, very clear code of ethics in terms of prior informed consent, in terms of what will happen if any drugs are ultimately developed from this. I mean, it was a good thing to go. The biopiracy issue, you know, made us be more diligent in the field to make sure that if there was any ever going to be any kind of medicinal development, that indigenous folks that pointed us in that direction, that gave us the lead, or the community, or the country, that they were ultimately going to benefit from it.
If the biopiracy narrative is mostly, at least, untrue, has the whole jungle medicine project been largely a failure? Have pharmaceutical monies lost, you know, untold millions of dollars trying to find these medicines and then never find anything?
Yeah, I can't say how much they put into the research and development, because that's way out of my area, and I know that it's incredibly expensive. I can say that that several pharmaceutical companies got very interested in the tropical realm because of the evolution of the jungle medicine narrative, and several companies set up agreements with countries in the developing world whereby they would invest money in the protection of particular tropical forested areas in exchange for exclusive rights to look at plants for possible drug patenting. But over the years, because of the emergence of the biopiracy issue, pharmaceutical companies simply lost interest, and almost all of them moved away. And there were almost no successes whatsoever. There is a group called the Shaman Pharmaceutical, which has changed its name. And after I published the book, I did get comments from one of the leaders of that group that, in fact, they had come up with a very, very important medicinal plant that was transitioned into a pharmaceutical as a treatment for extreme diarrhea in HIV/AIDS patients. And they also had worked with indigenous people, and that whatever money was coming out of this development was going to be funneled in part back into the community. So it really, it was a fair and equitable agreement. And to the degree that pharmaceutical companies get interested again in the tropics, I think that it will be a pretty level playing field.
So, you know, one of the things that I wonder about as when we consider this issue of biopiracy and its reality and its overinflation is how effective that narrative has been for these indigenous communities and other groups to protect either their resources or their knowledge, or to get some kind of reasonable compensation for what is of their knowledge. And so I'm wondering just a little bit about, even if the narrative isn't exactly correct, has it been politically effective?
Well, I can say from my own experience and from the experience of people I've talked to in the field that pretty much everyone in the developing world, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, are very, very aware of the idea that there are some possibly blockbuster medicinal plants waiting to be discovered, and that they are going to churn out tons and tons of profits for somebody. And they are all very, very much well aware of this. About 15 years ago, a whole series of countries made it almost impossible to do any research with ethnobotany because of fear of exploitation of indigenous folk, but especially, you know, super lucrative plants being spirited away to the U.S. or to Europe. And it's only in the last 10 years that we've been able to start doing this again. But indigenous folks are very, very clearly aware of this. There's even in some instances, it's hard to even, because the work that I've done has never been with about bioprospecting. I'm really much more in the spiritual healing realm. But it's hard to get people to talk about it because they are, you know, either fearful that you're going to be using this knowledge, to help develop a medicinal drug, but that they're not going to get any compensation for it. And I've noticed also when I was working many years ago in Borneo, in in Brunei Darussalam, that indigenous folks, when we start talking about medicinal plants, they would say, oh, yeah, yeah, we know about these. And, you know, we're really interested and these are super important to us. And, you know, it's like their perception of the value of their knowledge has definitely changed over time. I don't think there would be, you know, to the degree there was exploitation, certainly there was during the colonial era. I think indigenous folks are pretty wise, and I mean indigenous by, you know, indigenous peasant or diaspora people in the tropics. They're pretty wise to the whole thing.
And so do you have a vision then of what responsible ethnobotany should be doing in the world? If it's not to be trying to gain this knowledge for its dissemination or something like that. What should the project of ethnobotany be trying to do out there?
Well, that is a good question. I think that most of the people at this point that work with the relationship between plants and people and the developing world, in almost every instance, what they are trying to do is try to encourage the retention of this knowledge of nature that has been passed on and accrued for generations and generations, we're trying to encourage young people to continue to assimilate this knowledge because we believe it's going to be super important in the future. In many, many instances, we and also aid agencies and governments are identifying that a lot of not just the medicinal plants, but a lot of the other useful species in tropical and subtropical landscapes that have been exploited as subsistence articles forever, that they have all kinds of values outside of the immediate community. We refer to these as non-timber forest products, and these products have become very, very important, both at the national and the international trade level. And so as we're seeking ways to enhance the lives and livelihoods of people in the tropical realm, one of the strategies is to identify where there are markets for these plants, to a lesser extent, animals for obvious reasons, where there are markets for them, and then most importantly, how to help local people to learn to exploit these plants on a sustainable basis. Obviously, you know, when the market was simply local for whether it was a fiber or a medicine or a fuel or whatever, sustainability wasn't an issue, but there are definitely some plants out there. I'm working with a plant in Southeast Africa, the pepper bark tree, that's been exploited to death because it is so widely perceived as a healing plant throughout much of Southern Africa, and it's been on the international market for, you know, the last 30 years or so, and in some countries it's been driven to extinction. So I think at this point, the real focus of ethnobotany is not to develop new products that can help us in the developed world. The focus is coming up with ways to transition the knowledge of nature in the tropical realm to help the people that are there.
It's well put. So that covers most of what I wanted to ask you about the book. Is Is there anything I've missed? Anything you want to make sure is here on this interview about your book that I may have not thought to ask?
Well, no. I mean, I think that anytime you get into an endeavor and it grows, and the book obviously grew in directions. I mean, some of it I'd done research in, and I was very familiar with the literature, and some of it was completely new to me. And the very last chapter on kind of the development of these destruction narratives in environmental science, that was a really, really interesting, exciting area to me. But it was also very disheartening to find that that we have been constructing these kinds of narratives in the world of environmental problems for a long time, but that they almost always had the outcome of blaming local people for bigger problems. And so that ultimately justifying us moving in with our managerial expertise, or in the case of East Africa, you know, people are the problem with wildlife. So let's move them out of these protected areas so that ecotourists and wildlife tourists can come in. I found that very, very disheartening, and it was new to me. The other thing that I find that I found interesting about just the whole idea of narratives and environmental science, and the fact that environmental problems tend to develop so slowly and quietly, and the disconnect between cause and effect is so great, that narratives are a great way to go about transitioning the arcane world of science and scientists to the general public. And there are a lot of people in the scientific community now are talking about this because we need to get the word out there. Obviously, climate change is way up there at the top of it. It is a great way to parlay what we're learning, but publishing in arcane journals out to the public. But at the same time, we need to be careful with it. You know, you can only scream, you know, the world's about to go to Armageddon too many times and have it not happen before people stop believing you. So this book was certainly, there were parts of it that I was pretty familiar with, but it was very much of a learning experience and almost autobiographical in a way, because I went to Brazil. I used to work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Endangered Species Office. And when I found out about the destruction of the rainforests, I quit my job and went back to graduate school to save them. And what I've learned is there are certainly problems there, but they don't necessarily just need outsiders.
Well, great. So what's your next project? What's your next book-length project?
Well, the next book, the project I'm working on right now is with a colleague at the New York Botanical Garden. And we're actually not looking at medicine this time. We're looking at foods, and we're looking at the movement of green, sounds a little arcane, but green leafy vegetables over the course of the slave trade that moved from Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, to the tropical America. We're looking at it as part of a bigger theme of green vegetables in Africa, because it's a topic that doesn't get very much publicity. And in terms of the nutritional interests and needs of many, many African people, these are crucial resources. There's over 1,000 species of wild and partially cultivated plants that the leaves or the immature fruit pods are cooked into stews and soups and all and eaten raw. And they're absolutely chock-a-block with phytonutrients, and they are super, super important, you know, especially for women and children. And so I'm kind of moving into the area of these green vegetables. And I was interested because I've been working in Brazil on and off for years that I wanted to see how much of them managed to survive over the course of the slave trade. But ultimately, next book-length manuscript is going to be looking at sacred foods. The provisional title is Dining with God, but we'll see how that evolves.
Well, I look forward to that. Well, thank you so much for your time, and look forward to seeing your new work.
Thank you, Lance. It was really nice talking to you.